The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows how to help you save this 4th of July. Upgrade your laundry routine with the new and exclusive first-of-its-kind all-in-one vented laundry combo. Wash and dry in just 68 minutes. Save up to 40% on select major appliances. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Shop Samsung this July 4th at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
A Formula One driver's teammate is their biggest rival. Failure to beat them in the same car can be career-defining.
If you're up against the most overrated driver on the field, you're going to be flying. You're going to become a legend. Whereas if you're up against one of the most underrated drivers in the field, you're in jeopardy. Nico Hülkenberg is a tough teammate to be up against. Had someone not employed such a fast driver alongside me, maybe everything would have gone differently.
Competing against a much more experienced Nico Hülkenberg in 2017, Jolyon Palmer knew he faced an uphill battle to stay in F1 the following season. But that didn't make the manner of his Renault exit any easier.
My brother sent me a message and was like, oh, have you seen this? And it was Autosport sites to replace Palmer. I was like, what? Genuinely, that was the first I heard. I'm at home and I clicked on it. I was reading, you know, my own downfall on Autosport.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. In 2014, Jolyon Palmer became the first British driver to win the GP2 title since Lewis Hamilton. He set what was then a record for the most points scored in a GP2 season, and he arrived in Formula One 2 years later full of hope and expectation. After a promising rookie season with Renault, Palmer's second year in F1 didn't go to plan. He was replaced by Carlos Sainz before the end of the year, and he finished his career with a total of 9 championship points and a highest finish of 6th. So why did the Brit's career end so abruptly? Jolyon tells me why a crash at the opening race in Australia put him on the back foot, how his teammate Nico Hülkenberg had a car advantage that he could do nothing about, and when he started to lose his enjoyment of racing. You'll also hear the extraordinary story of how Jolyon found out he was being replaced by Sainz, why he stopped using social media, and what he loves about commentating on F1 TV today. Jolyon's intelligent, he's funny, and he knows the sport inside out. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Jolyon, great to have you on the show. How are you?
Yeah, great. What a pleasure to be here, Tom.
There's a lot to talk to you about, but let's start with your F1 career. 2 seasons with Renault in which you improved every season, almost by the race. What might have happened, do you think, if you'd had a 3rd year?
I actually think you've been quite kind there. If you take the stats, I think I improved, and one of my best race was my penultimate race in Singapore, maybe my 3rd last race in Singapore. But in my eyes, my first year was much better than my second year, which is why it was only a 2-year career, I think. Yeah, first year I was with K-Mag in 2016. The car wasn't good. So that was the thing. We had a very bad car at the start of the year. It got better. I got a point in Malaysia and that was great. But the second year, the car was better, but I was comparatively worse, I think.
Well, let's take that in chronological order, because I think you had a few things against you at the start of 16, your first season. First up, the number of preseason tests was reduced from, I think it was 3 to 2. How did that affect you? Were you ready when you went to Melbourne for the first race?
I was quite ready, actually, because I'd had a lot of FP1s the year before, so I was already embedded in the team. Enstone, it was Lotus, that became Renault. In some ways, yeah, I was quite ready. In other ways, the reliability then, this is not even that long ago, but you'd do a day and it would be like 50 laps in Barcelona, which is a short lap as well. And now they're clocking 150 plus in a day. So yeah, compared to nowadays, there's less days, but the days that I had were less fruitful. So, and then came to Melbourne, first race, and I'd never driven there. And the Friday was a washout. So, yeah, in some ways I was feeling nice with the team. I'd driven the car, I was feeling okay. The car we had in 2016, it was basically the 2015 Lotus with a worse engine in, the Renault instead of the Mercedes.
Well, that was actually going to be one of my points as well, is that you went from the best power unit on the grid to, well, really the worst, right? And how much of a shock was that for you?
It was a shame. It was a big shame. Because the 2015 Lotus was a pretty undeveloped car, but it was fine. But it had the Mercedes rocket ship at the time. So Grosjean got the podium in Spa. I drove it in countless FP1s, and it was a competitive car. Then, you know, Renault bought the team. It was a great thing, really. You had a manufacturer come in, and we were limping with Lotus and only just finished the season. So it was great. We're all buzzed for Renault coming in. So jump on the sim and do a lap of the 2015 car, always in Barcelona. And, you know, felt fine, done that all year. And then they're like, okay, let's plumb in the Renault numbers now. And I did a lap, and straight away, like, no speed on the straight at all. And it was like, oh, wow. Ah, great the Renault are in, but can we find some power, please?
And you knew immediately that it was going to be a difficult year because of that.
Well, I think we hoped that it would be better than it was, but particularly the start of the year, we had the inferior engine. The Renault engine was not good. And we were competing with, you know, even Manna at that point we're in, really underfunded, underdeveloped, but they had the Mercedes engine. So they were difficult to pass. Williams were struggling. They had the Mercedes engine. In fact, I think 2016, they were okay. That was tough, but we did have a decent team at Renault. So as soon as we had the funding again, there were developments in place. And I look back quite fondly on 2016, weirdly, even though it was a really tough year. I think I drove quite well in it. In the end, the start wasn't easy, but the car came on well. We had loads of developments in the pipeline. And by the end, we were sort of getting towards lower midfield territory.
All right. There was another thing going against you, I think, at the start of the season as well. It's quite a long list. But do you remember elimination qualifying?
Yeah.
Where it was that sort of mad moment in Formula One history. I think it was every 90 seconds of each qualifying segment, a driver was eliminated. And you had that in your first race. As you said a moment ago, you'd never been to Melbourne before. And then you had that jeopardy as well. How much more complicated did it make it?
I didn't mind these complications. We also, I don't know if this is next on the list, but we had the team radio ban in 2016. So as a rookie coming in, there was no team radio. So you couldn't be instructed what switches to change or what. So you had to, there was loads to learn coming into 2016. The qualifying part just felt like the tip of the iceberg, really. I quite enjoyed it in Melbourne, and I had a good qualifying, got into Q2.
Out-qualified K-Mag, your teammate.
Yeah, I had a really strong debut qualifying. And I remember coming out of the car in Melbourne, elimination qualifying, a load of chat about it in the winter, kind of excitement when a format changes like that. Got out the car, straight away you do the weigh-in, you go into the pen, and everyone was like, well, that was a disgrace, wasn't it? I was like, I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it from the cockpit. But obviously, you know, I was living a very different version of events to what everyone else was watching on. So,
Did you do anything differently in the car? Did you approach it differently? Or it was just, we're going to get out there and I'm just going to do some laps and I will be informed if I'm knocked out?
Well, we worked out when we had to be on track and, you know, what the cutoffs were. So we knew that everyone had to go out and put one lap on the board to make sure you're not the last car, or the last two maybe would get knocked out. I think it was different for us at Renault because there was never a moment in qualifying where we might not have been knocked out. We were never safe. So if you got through into Q2 in the Renault that we had in 2016, that was a result. So probably if you're a big team, it's a bit of a faff, you know you're safely going through. So you just do a lap and then park it up. But for us, we knew we had to do one lap. The track was going to evolve in Melbourne. It was a washout on the Friday. So you had to keep going back out to improve. And because we knew we were not going to make Q3, we just used all the tyres. We went out to go and improve. I think we had no tyres left in Q2 because we had given everything in Q1 already. But it felt exciting to me. But obviously, it was not the format that stayed for very long.
And it did create the jeopardy, I guess, that Bernie Ecclestone wanted, in that Daniel Kvyat got knocked out in Q1 in Melbourne in a Red Bull.
There we go. And I remember watching on, because there was, I think the flaw of the format was there was only so many laps you could do. It was basically still a one lap qualifying. You just had to be on track. and you couldn't just rush out of the pits because you still had to do an outlap, and then the knockout came. It knocked Grosjean out. He was in the Haas. It was really quick that weekend, but Haas mistimed the calculations. And I remember just sitting in the garage, he was flying. He was like going to put it in the top five, and he was just knocked out 30 seconds before he could put the lap in. So it was great to see from the Renault cockpit.
That format lasted two races. It was then in Bahrain as well, and then it was axed. I think the front-running teams didn't like the jeopardy. Just you now with your punditry head on, do you think it should have stayed?
Or? No. Because to be fair, I got knocked out in Q1 in Bahrain and watched the rest of it, and it wasn't great. So I think it was just I had such an excitement of my first qualifying. When you're in the cockpit, you're not, I don't know what's going on in the Mercedes garage, the Ferrari, the Red Bull. It was great that the Red Bull got knocked out. But I was so focused on delivering what was basically, I think, four laps we had in Melbourne. And I was so focused. I was loving it. This is, the most exhilarated I'd ever been in my career, driving in Formula One in a qualifying, great track. But then when the dust settles and you realize that actually we know who's on pole way before the checkered flag, or we know who's going to be knocked out way before the knockout, you realize that it doesn't work. So I was not like the last bastion for knockout qualifying, elimination qualifying. It's just that it was funny on my debut, I weirdly quite enjoyed it, came out and then realized that I think I was probably the only person in the world that enjoyed that.
Look, tell us a little bit more about the ebb and flow of that first season in Formula One, because that first point in Malaysia came quite late on. Did frustration set in at any point?
No, I never got frustrated at all. I think because it was still my debut season. So, everything going out there and racing in Formula One was exciting. Of course, I would love to have been further up the field, but everything was a chance to show that I deserved to be in Formula One. So the first part of my season, Melbourne was actually great, but then I had a few tricky races and had, getting up to speed with it all. I had probably the next three or four races were a little tougher. But after that, I sort of worked out how things were working in Formula One a bit better. And just even the head-to-heads, trying to get a Renault into Q2 was a good challenge. For points, we had to get lucky because you needed someone to drop out ahead. We didn't have at any time a car that deserved to be in the top 10, really, on pure pace. But still trying to get close to it was good. And I was on a one-year deal. So I still knew that I had to be showing well against K-Mag, who was on a one-year deal. And, both of us wanted to extend with Renault and see the team get better. So for me, it was the challenge was, okay, scoring points would be brilliant. Doing something headline grabbing would be great. That was a pipe dream. But beating K-Mag was the important thing, really, in that. And as the year went on, I got more comfortable in the team. And suddenly you could get a point in Malaysia or just more drives. I think Q2 became more regular and it was enjoyable.
What kind of a challenge was K-Mag? Was he a very different driver to you in terms of what he wanted from the car? Was he a generous driver? Did you guys share information?
I liked being teammates with K-Mag. He's a very straightforward guy. Says things how they are. It's how I've always worked as well. He was super quick. He's a really talented driver. I think we've seen that all the time in his career. And probably in those early races, I realized how quick he was as well. I think Melbourne was a good start for me. But then I was like, well, okay, this guy is actually really quick. And he punched in a great result in Russia, got loads of points for the team, and that sort of stood him out a little bit. But then there were a couple of things with K-Mag where we'd go through practice and he'd always be really slow in high-speed corners. I'd be like, oh, he's a bit off it this weekend. And then you get to the first lap of qualifying and bam, he'd be straight there on it. So he's obviously
holding stuff back.
And he was a savvy driver, I think, as well, beneath it all. He was great on the brakes, great in high speed. He's a brave driver, I would say. But yeah, we were pretty evenly matched overall. And I felt as the year went on, I understood the car very well and started getting more out of it. Yeah, just working on the setup, trying to fine-tune things. And he was very naturally talented. But I think as the year went on, we were probably very evenly matched. And in the end, probably the last part, I felt more comfortable in the battle.
So were you surprised when he was dropped at the end of the year and went to Haas and Hülkenberg comes in?
Well, Hülkenberg came in when we were both still gunning for the drive. So Hülkenberg came in a little earlier. So at that point, we knew that one of us was going to be going. And at the same time as Hülkenberg's announced, it was the time where I was starting to be on top more often than not of Kev. So I was pushing. We had Fred as the boss at the time, and I was pushing. I was like selling myself. I was a rookie. I was starting to be quicker than K-Mag. I think he certainly had a bit more hype coming into the year. He was already done a great year with McLaren. But I was, yeah, I was absolutely gunning for the drive. And most weeks in the second half of the year, I think I out-qualified him more. We both had a point later on in the season, but I felt like I was on top. But then I got the call that I was staying. It coincided with Kev getting the call that he was going to Haas. I don't know if he chose to leave to Haas or there was a knock-on effect. I don't know exactly how that came about, but it was happy days because, you know, I was chuffed to be staying. It was a huge moment for me to be kept on. But it was also nice that he was happy and we finished the year harmoniously.
The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Julian, I love your analysis of Formula One now in your new role, if you like, as commentator and pundit. You're a detail man, and we're going to come on to that. But were you like that as a racing driver as well? Were you really into the detail?
Yeah, I loved it. Always. I'm a bit of geeky, so I love the data. And I was always trying to find a way to go quicker. I was a hardworking driver. And so, I'd pour through all the data, try and find something to see from whether it's K-Mag or Nico Hülkenberg as well. The answers are always in the data. Every single thing that you do is in the car is monitored and you see it in squiggly lines. And I grew up racing with open data. So you could always see in my junior career, the data from the fastest guy. And you basically plot to try and work out, well, he's a gear up in this corner, doing something different in this corner, braking later or whatever. It doesn't mean you can do it, but it means that you can try and do it and understand what's going on. And yeah, everything's there to see. It's just whether you can actually do it.
And how much confidence did you have, particularly in that first season? Because when you look through your junior career, you know, you beat Stoffel Vandoorne to the title in GP2. You've actually had some phenomenal teammates, Marcus Ericsson in GP2, Felipe Nasr, and then you have Hülkenberg and Magnussen in Formula One. I mean, did you come in thinking, yeah, I'm a match for anyone here?
Yeah, I think you have to think that. You have to think that. Yeah, I had a run of Ericsson in GP2. Nasr in GP2 obviously went on to race in Formula One. Magnussen, super talented, very fast. And then Hülkenberg, who was probably the quickest of the lot. But you, as any driver, you can't go into a season thinking you're not going to match him. And even if maybe some were maybe more naturally talented, there'd always be a way, like I said, with the data or trying to work out how to get on top. I never believed that I couldn't.
What was your greatest strength?
I always thought I was a good racer, probably more in the junior series. We had no DRS in GP2. I loved wheel-to-wheel racing. That was probably be my favorite thing in the whole of driving would be wheel-to-wheel racing, chucking in a lunge, elbows out stuff. I loved it. In Formula One, it was obviously harder. You know, in the lower series, we had the same car as everyone in the field. So if you're on a charge that day, you can blitz through loads of people. I went from, I think it's 26th to 8th in Monza in a GP2 race in my title-winning season. And I passed pretty much everyone on track, and it was an absolute buzz. In Formula One, you find that, especially for me in a Renault, there's only so many cars that you can overtake before you reach the where a Renault is at. And overtaking is harder. The dirty air was a lot bigger. You got DRS, and it sort of changed the way that you raced a bit more. But I still enjoyed it.
But the rules and regs are much harder in Formula One when it comes to racing. And as a pundit, you are quite quick to jump on drivers that move even slightly under braking when they're defending. Did you have that attitude when you were racing yourself? And if you did it hold you back? Because I always think the best drivers are the ones who are a little bit rebellious, don't always follow the rules, weren't the teacher's pet at school, that kind of thing.
Well, I think there's a level. I'm not too harsh on drivers. I've been there myself, so I know that sometimes drivers move under braking a little bit. Everyone pushes the rules a bit. But I think in the end, you want to know that it's fair. And you want to know where the rules are so you can go up to them. But if you're fighting with people that are over the rules, it's not a fair race. I think I was a fair driver my whole way through. I think some of the great racers, I think someone like Fernando Alonso probably is maybe the best wheel-to-wheel racer out there. Him, Carlos Sainz, there's some great guys out there, very hard wheel-to-wheel, but they often come out ahead. But I think they're very fair. You never see them moving under braking, or very rarely.
All right. What did you make of Fernando Alonso and George Russell's incident at Melbourne earlier this year? Was that Fernando just using every trick in the book to create dirty air for George? Or did he go over the line?
I thought it was okay. It was all every trick in the book. But he backed off into the corner. George never got close to actually contact with the other car, had a car length between them, and went off the road. And he was looking down at the steering wheel. I think he misjudged it. I think he could have reacted better to Fernando being a bit cheeky with the rules. But I thought it was okay. It wasn't a brake test. It was by no means really a brake test. The brake test is when, in my opinion, you know, you got to slam on the brakes to stop hitting someone. He simply slowed into the corner and George closed way more than he thought, caught the dirty air and lost it. So it's a grey area. I can understand why it was investigated, and I can understand people have different opinions, but yeah, I think it was acceptable. And you have sometimes, someone might have an engine failure into a corner or lose power, and then they don't accelerate as anticipated into a corner, and the guy behind doesn't usually fire it off into the barriers.
Let's go back to your strengths. You had a lot of success in the junior formulas on street tracks, Monaco, Singapore, to name two. And if we call Hungary Monaco without the walls, that as well, right? What was it about you and street tracks?
I loved them. I don't know why. I always went well in those ones that you named. It was a buzz racing on a street circuit. There's a lot more jeopardy. You're racing a lot more on instinct. It's bumpy. It's very difficult. You get right up to the barriers. I didn't feel like I did much different on a street circuit than on the regular circuits, but I did have great results. So Monaco and Singapore were my standouts in GP2 and F1. Hungary was, as you said, was a good one. I don't know if it was everyone else starting to withdraw a little bit when the barriers were there or what, but I loved it. I loved the challenge of going fast, don't crash.
Do you push as hard on a street track? You racing drivers, not just you, Jolyon. Is the limit the same on a street track as it is in Bahrain where there's lots of runoff?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You can't drive slower against whatever field you're in, because they're so talented that you're going to be nowhere if you start to drive safe and leave margin. So you see it all the time in Formula One. Everyone's brushing the barriers in the end of qualifying. The difference probably is people are building up to the limit a little slower. So in Bahrain, you're going to fly into whatever, turn one, turn four in the early laps, have a big smoky lockup and realize, I can't brake at that level. You can't do that on a street circuit because you're going to plunge it into the wall. So you build up more on a street circuit, but also the guys out there, this is top level drivers, they don't build up that slowly. they still find the grip very quickly, and then it's evolving the whole way as well. So you have to be wringing the neck and have no margin for error.
Actually, back to a qualifying question for you. You weren't around in the era of one lap qualifying. Do you think that would be a good thing? Is that a good challenge for the drivers?
I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it come back for the sprint qualifyings. That seems to me like a really obvious solution to mix up the sprint format to the normal qualifying format. It's a different challenge. I don't know how they'd sort the order for who goes when.
Championship order was what it was back in the day.
Yeah, and then you inherently have a sort of bias towards the main guys because the track evolution we see is pretty big. could there be a different element for the sprint to mix things up, which is what the sprint's designed for? I don't know. But I think the challenge would be great. I used to enjoy watching One Shot Quality. I don't know if I'm looking back with rose-tinted glasses again, but I was watching it as a fan, and it was a great challenge. And you'd get sometimes a sprinkling of rain. Sure, it'd be unfair, but it would give us a Suzuka 2005 race.
Exactly. And I actually think you would have been really good at it. Because one thing that's coming through here is that I think any chance of jeopardy, and Palmer was right there, whether it was the elimination qualifying in 2016, whether it's, you know, the chance of jeopardy on a street track, seems to be what brought out the best in you.
I'd certainly have given it a good crack. I don't know if I would have ended up spinning out or whatever, but yeah, something different, I think, was always fun. In the end, for the drivers that are going out in Q1, it is almost like a one-shot qual, but you're out there with everyone else. It's a two-shot qual, effectively. So this was my 2016, was you get two laps, and that's your qualifying. If you have the luxury of being in a fast car, you have your two laps in Q1, then you change the setup a little bit, go better in Q2, and it's not a one-shot qual. But if you're at the back, and like Sauber's now, it's not quite a one-shot qual, but it's not far from it. So it's a good skill. It's a skill that everyone possesses, but the random element obviously comes up when you've just got to feel it out on one lap.
Right. What about 2017 then? Year two. Winter testing goes well. I seem to remember you ended third fastest. I think you were behind only Ferrari and Red Bull. How hopeful were you guys going into that season?
I was so hopeful. You're right. Winter testing was amazing. The cars had changed. We'd gone from 2016, low downforce, a bang average Renault, new set of regulations. We'd built for it. I think there were great people back in the factory at Enstone. We still had a pretty bad engine, but we had a great car. And yeah, testing was also Barcelona. We had a decent higher downforce package and we were flying. And I felt in the groove straight away. And I turned up to Melbourne thinking, this is what Formula One is all about. I know Hülkenberg is going to be a big challenge in the other car. But, you know, we're a team. We've got to get some points on the board. And I'm excited. We're looking at Q3 appearances and, yeah, racing with the big boys.
So what happened?
It all went wrong very quickly.
Why did it start to unravel?
There were a few things in 2017 that changed pretty much the course of my career, really. Number one, I crashed in Melbourne FP2. And Melbourne FP1, we rock up. Me and Nico have been really closely matched in pre-season testing. As you said, we've been competitive. Melbourne FP1, my car, I can't remember the issue. Something went wrong with it in the first couple of laps. So I didn't get any running. I'd done that the year before, it would be okay. But FP2, I was trying to make up for it, and I think on the second flying lap or third flying lap, I made a mistake, and I dropped it in the barriers, final corner. Pushing too hard too soon, it was, you know, not a great moment. It meant that the whole Friday was pretty bad. But the bigger thing was my car was rebuilt incorrectly. So when I then turned up on Saturday, the rear anti-roll bar had been installed the wrong way around. So basically it meant I had a disconnected rear bar. And the car was just lolling all around the place. I just couldn't drive it on the rest of the weekend. And I was saying, I don't know what's happening. I've driven this in pre-season. Even my 1.5 laps, 1.75 laps on a Friday FP2, I felt connected to the car. I felt like I could press on before I dropped it. And suddenly, I just couldn't drive the thing. I was understeering, oversteering. It was horrible. And to compound matters, I then couldn't run low fuel in qualifying because we had a fuel pickup issue. So I qualified with, I don't know, 30 kilos of fuel on board. I qualified last by miles. And it sort of set the tone for, you know, a bit of a negative spiral at the start of the year. It was a really horrible way to start the year. I sat down on Sunday morning with Alan Prost and Cyril, and they were saying, oh, you need to just build the confidence again. You had a crash on Friday. I understand that you're missing confidence and this is where things are at. I was like, no, guys. The car doesn't feel right. I'm telling you, I've driven this thing. I know how to drive a Formula One car. Something is wrong. And they were looking at the numbers. They couldn't see it. I was like, I know something's up here. Anyway, did the race. The latest mechanical ruled me out after about 10 laps. And it was such a tough weekend. Got out and I was like, right, let's move on. So my engineer calls at the end on Sunday. He's like, right, good news and bad news. Good news is we found what was wrong with the car. The rear bar was installed incorrectly. I don't know how we didn't spot it. Bad news is that that's on us and we'll try and make amends. So that was the first big thing for me in Melbourne. It just set a really negative tone for the season. But then there was another big thing that was really the bigger thing for me and Renault, which was a fuel flow meter is a really kind of insignificant part of a car. And it's a part that the FIA distributes. And they're all within a certain tolerance. And that basically controls how much fuel you can use, how much effectively power you have in the car. And Renault, at the start of the season, got one that was exceptionally good and one that was normal. So obviously, the one that was exceptionally good went to the driver that they had signed for big money and, you know, understandably would be the stronger driver, which was Nico. It just meant that on circuits, particularly, you know, power-sensitive tracks, he had quite a big advantage. I measured it up towards half a second a lap. And he was just flying on the straights. And what was harder is there was nothing I could do or say, because this was a part that eventually was taken away from Nico because it was too good. But if I mentioned anything before, then the FIA would take it away. It would be terrible for Renault and I would be the fault for it. So the comparison was always really tricky in the first half of the year. Eventually it did get taken away because the FIA saw that it was too good at summer break. And the second part of the year was we were on an even keel. But they were sort of two things that made life very tricky. And I'd say Nico's a rapid driver. So even on a even keel, he was going to be really tough to beat.
Were you tempted to ask for another fuel flow meter?
We had some in the pool. So we had a few in the pool, but we just had one, a freak one that was so good. And I remember we had the same engine as same power unit as Red Bull, who were using the Renault. And there were quotes from them saying, I don't know what's going on. We're not getting even treatment with Renault because I can see Hülkenberg is way quicker than us on the straights. And I was like, yeah, I know why. But I can't say anything because all that will happen is my teammate will go way slower and it won't help anyone.
And then what did all this do to your confidence?
Well, it's tricky because you're always compared to your teammate. So inevitably, I would be outqualified. And honestly, I would be outqualified anyway. If you look at the stats, Nico was super quick. He was a faster driver than me, but it exacerbated the difference between us. So then you start answering questions about why I'm struggling so much. And it just becomes a really difficult situation. You've got a really fast driver. I'm trying my best against him. I've got a deficit naturally in the car. When we were bringing upgrades, they would go to Nico first as well. I understand so much of it from Renault's point of view. But it was such a difficult position to be in from the other side of the garage. So inevitably, the confidence takes a hit and I just wasn't fighting on an even keel.
JP, when Stoffel Vandoorne came on this podcast, he said that in his final year at McLaren, he got to the point where he no longer wanted to go to the races because he was feeling so down about how things had gone. How bad did it get for you?
I mean, I lost my enjoyment of racing. As a result, in the end of all of this, it was like I said, I loved 2016. And my dream was to race in Formula One. And the enjoyment in the end, from being such a high hope in 2017, it just really faded quickly. And I still enjoyed the cut and thrust of racing. I still give it absolutely everything to try and score some points. And I did in Singapore in the end, which was a buzz and it was great. But just turning up every week and facing loads of questions. Robert Kubica was starting to test the Renault. In the end, you know, I didn't see out the season. It takes a mental toll. And, you know, I was getting a lot of abuse on social media at the time as well, which is, you know, part and parcel of being an athlete. But
you're brushing that off, right? But actually, how difficult is it for a sports person to get that abuse and to ignore it?
It's difficult for anyone to ignore it. I hate social media with a passion because...
And does it extend back to
yeah,
that?
Yeah, absolutely. It gives... It's used sometimes in great ways, but so many times it is used in such a negative way. And it's people that... I don't know why they choose to voice these opinions, but remember there was a race in Canada. I finished 11th place and I was looking at them. I think it was Grosjean got a point and I was gunning for him the last 20 laps. I was like, come on, something happened. And it didn't happen. I finished 11th. And I had a run of 11th place finishes and I was very close to the points, didn't make it. But, you know, you look on social media and some of the vitriol that was on there was just unimaginable. So in the end, I'd had enough of it. But I do think it's a tough world in not Formula One, but in any walk of life.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Ironically, that race in Singapore, tell me if I'm wrong, but was that the weekend when you got the bad news about being replaced?
Yeah. Yeah. So I had, before Singapore, I read it. I was at home and browsing, and my brother sent me a message. He was like, oh, have you seen this? And it was Autosport, Sainz to replace Palmer. I was like, what?
Was that the first you'd heard of it?
Genuinely, that was the first I heard. Autosport ran the story. I'm at home and I clicked on it. I was reading, you know, my own downfall on Autosport. So, yeah.
I got to stop you there. So tell me about the conversations that you were having with Cyril Abitbol, Alain Prost. I mean, he was the, okay, an advisor, an ambassador, but were you getting no indication from them?
I'm not an idiot. I knew that I was not going to be staying at the end of the year. This season was not going well. I didn't know if I'd finish the season. I hoped I would. I was trying my best. I actually had a great run in Spa where I was faster than Hülkenberg for pretty much the only time that year.
Mega in Sector 2, I seem to remember.
Mega, that's where all the corners are, Tom. No, I was flying. I don't know why, but everything just clicked in Spa. And then I had a gearbox issue in Q3 and I couldn't put a blooming time on the board. And so again, it went on the stats to Nico. But the amount of unreliability I had also in 2017 was just ridiculous.
Silverstone, you didn't even get to start your home race.
I genuinely think there must be a stat for, in the modern era, entries versus DNSs. And I had one in 2016, one in 2017. Silverstone didn't even start the home race, let alone the mechanical DNFs I had. There was so much that was difficult. Silverstone was a bad one because I started 11th, home race. We had a good car, loved the track, and then I just start spewing hydraulic fluid on the formation lap and it had to watch on. But anyway, after all of that, I knew I wasn't going to stay on. I still didn't expect to read my demise on Autosport. But anyway, so no, I was like, right, well, I'll wait for someone from the team who's going to obviously see this and reach out. No one did. So I came out to Singapore. Obviously, I'm in the press conference, you know, some news has dropped about me. So I'm in the press conference on Thursday. Andy Stobart was our head of media. He's like, are you good to go up? And I was like, by the way, no. There's no way I can go up and face the world's media until someone tells me what is conclusively happening here. So I was waiting and there was no sign of Cyril, no sign of management. I was like, you want me to send into the press conference off the back of some Autosport article and that's what I'm going to go off? You know, let's have a sit down and at least tell me to my face what's going on. So eventually Cyril came over and explained it. It didn't shock me. Obviously, I knew the news, but the whole year was just handled in a pretty bad way.
But why hadn't he spoken to you prior to that? It seems extraordinary.
I don't know. You'd have thought when a lot of deals in Formula One, they're super harsh, they're super secret until there's an announcement. And probably the Autosport story came before Renault were ready to tell the world. But you'd have thought after a story broke, I'd hear from my boss to tell me roughly, is it true, is it not? I didn't. And I had to force the conversation to hear from him. So it left a bad taste on a tough year.
And so we go to Suzuka, the Japanese Grand Prix. It's your last race. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but actually, was it a relief in the end just to get away from that mayhem?
Yeah, certainly part of it was closing a chapter that was a difficult time, really. I had some great memories, actually, of that Japan race, because I knew I had, it was like closure to my F1 career, really. I knew that was going to be it. And I'd remember even, and I managed to finish the race, which was good. The car held on. And on the in lap, just soaking it in, and the parade lap and things, just thinking like, this is, I'm pleased with what I've achieved here, even if it's not gone how I would want it to do. And, you know, we've spoken all about loads of issues. But in the end, I still think probably got to the level that I got to in Formula One. Even in spite of it, I don't think I was a future champion. I do think Nico Hülkenberg was a level ahead of me. And it was a shame how things went. I would have liked them to go differently. I'd like to have been compared on a more even basis. But I had a good run. I could enjoy Japan. And then I was pretty tired. I was ready to step away.
It's kind of back to the question I asked right at the start, which is Renault go on to finish fourth in the Constructors' Championship the following year. In a good car, there's a little bit of me that wants to know what you could have done, even now.
It's a tricky one to answer. I think so much of Formula One is about comparing to your teammate and being in the right place at the right time. And I think, having had the experience I had, I think Nico Hülkenberg is a tough teammate to be up against. And had someone else come in and taken that Renault seat, had someone not employed such a fast driver alongside me, maybe everything would have gone differently, because you basically want to be up against the most overrated driver on the field. If you're up against the most overrated driver on the field, you're going to be flying. You're going to become a legend. Whereas if you're up against one of the most underrated drivers in the field, you're in jeopardy. And that's kind of how it goes. And I think I've seen something from K-Mac saying something similar when we were teammates. I came in and it was a tough one for him because he was expected to be beating me comfortably. And I was not so highly rated. And it didn't reflect all that well on him at the time that we were close. But I think Hülkenberg was underrated. He was super quick. So potentially, if there would have been a different teammate at the time, I don't want to put any names out there, but maybe the career could have gone on a little bit longer. And I think I was a solid driver, not a world champion, but I would have liked to have had some more years and seen what I could do.
I feel like I'm talking to Gerhard Berger, because I asked him, you know, who was your ideal teammate? And he just came straight back with about 1.5 seconds slower.
Yeah. But you want them to be so highly rated.
Yeah, yes.
I want someone that has had the golden career, but is just actually always had lucky breaks here or there.
Do you take heart from the fact that when Hülkenberg and Carlos Sainz were together in 18, Hülkenberg comprehensively beat him?
It didn't surprise me. And Carlos is a great driver, but I just think Hülkenberg is... he's rapid. On one lap, I still think he's one of the best out there. And in fact, he's now doing to Kev a similar thing to what he's doing to me. He's beating him comprehensively on one lap, which also doesn't surprise me. And Magnussen's got his own strengths. He's very good in the race. But if you want to stack up to someone on one lap quali, Hülkenberg is generally the career killer. He's so fast. And yeah, I was on the receiving end of it.
So with hindsight, and with the experience you've built in the Formula One paddock as a pundit, as a commentator, knowing the environment better now than you did back then, is there anything you'd do differently?
Long pause. Obviously, I'd cut out some individual mistakes, but on the...
I sort of mean politically.
I don't think there's anything I could do differently. I think my career played out as well as it could have done through being a reserve driver to getting the race seat. Even that was a really lucky break. And then keeping the seat, getting to 2017 was as the maximum I could have possibly achieved. And then I don't think there's anything that could have particularly been different. Maybe if Melbourne was different, there might have been a alternating of this magic power fuel flow meter or something. Maybe, you know, that was such a big thing for me.
I mean, you nailed your colours to Lotus Renault right from the outset with all the... you did 14 FP1s in 2015 for the team. But were there opportunities with other teams that you turned down to do that, for example? Could you have gone to Haas? Look at the amazing start they had.
After winning GP2, I was obviously desperate to get on the grid, but knew I wasn't going to be. So it was a case of trying to become a reserve driver and get some racing experience. I tested with Force India at the end of 2014, and there was an opportunity to go there as a reserve for 2015. But in the end, I went to Lotus because I got on very well with the management there. They gave me loads of FP1s. And I thought there was a better chance to get into a drive because Force India had Hülkenberg and Perez, two very established drivers. Lotus at the time had Grosjean and Maldonado. I thought that would be maybe where openings might come up. And so it came about. So it played out better than I could have possibly imagined up until then.
Why have you never raced anything since then? Have you not had a desire to race at Le Mans? Maybe do something with your brother Will? Or is it just a chapter that you have completely turned the page on and you're never going to race anything again?
I don't think I am now, not competitively. When my Formula One career was coming to an end, I was speaking to, you know, IndyCar conversation. I had a Formula E conversation. One of my old GP2 engineers was working in the Le Mans program. So there were conversations going on. The timing didn't quite work out for a couple of those deals. And like I said, a lot of it was my energy had been sapped out from the 2017 Formula One experience. I'd achieved the pinnacle of what I could have possibly achieved. I didn't think I'd get to Formula One when I started racing. And somehow these sliding doors moments happened. I got to Formula One. I achieved, it was a dream to race there. Then you change the dreams and want to get better. But in the end, I found my level. And I didn't have the hunger and the motivation to go and drive in the other series at that point. Because, a lot of it, the enjoyment had been sapped out in 2017. And I knew as well that there are some unbelievably good drivers in these other series who are so hungry for it. They're so motivated. Some of them could have been Formula One drivers as well if the stars had aligned for them. And if I'm not fully committed to racing in Formula E, if it's not going to mean everything to me to go and race in Formula E or any of the other series, then I'm not going to do that well. And I'd lost the hunger.
But as at a more basic level, do you not miss the buzz of driving a car on the limit in qualifying?
When I first stepped back into media, which was the next year, and I went to Monaco or Silverstone, and the light goes green at the end, and you're like, oh, God, that was good. And there's a few moments where I immediately missed it. But generally, I was just so at peace with what I achieved in Formula One. And like I said, I just achieved the most of what I could possibly have got out of it. The actual pure thrill of driving, I miss it a bit, but I really enjoy what I'm doing now as well. And working in Formula One in the media side, it's a really good privilege to be able to do as well and watch what I grew up watching. Yeah, you never know what's going to happen the next race. There's a lot of races in the season. I don't have a huge amount of time to go and do that. And my life is not Formula One. It's Formula One's a big part of it, but motorsport and that side of it, I enjoy doing other things as well.
Tell us more about the commentary, about the punditry. Can you relate to what Martin Brundle has said many times, which is that his racing career was just a fact-finding mission for what he's doing now?
I realise this basically refers to me now as well, yeah. Well, I think after doing just under 2 years of Formula One, and now I'm in my sixth year of being a commentator, my commentary career has way outlasted my driving career. So, that is very true. Because I was always a very analytical driver, I'd always try and see what anyone that I had data for was doing and trying to understand how to make myself better. I don't think I was naturally the most gifted driver, but I think because I worked hard at it, I achieved the most of what I could. You know, if I'm sitting at home watching the race with my family or friends, I'm going to bore them to tears with what's actually going on. And I'm a commentator, whether I like it or not. I'll be watching the Olympics and I naturally start like analyzing what's going on and looking at the paddle strokes in the kayaking or whatever. So it's just something that's built into me to just watch sport and, yeah, think about how things are being won or lost. And annoyingly for everyone else, I just vocalize everything.
You're talking about marginal gains and things like that. Have you not been interested in maybe joining the management side of a Formula One team? I mean, I think you've actually got a degree in management or something.
I do, yeah.
But is that side of the fence interested you?
I would be interested to work for a Formula One team as well, because I do, all of it. You know, getting the most out of performance is something I'm very interested in. You see some former drivers that go into that line of work. I enjoy what I'm doing in the media. I don't know where the future lies, but I haven't given it a huge amount of thought. I haven't gone knocking on doors to try and get a job back in the teams, because also just working in the media generally, whoever it is, it's nice to have the overall picture and see things, and honestly not have the pressure as well of performance depending on me. And that's a nice shift, is, you know, I'll turn up, call the race, see what's going on, but I could do a bad job, I could do a horrible commentary, but it's not going to be 800 people relying on me doing that.
Just very briefly then, on 2024, strength in depth, do you think this is the best grid of drivers the sport's ever had?
I think next year could be better.
By what? You mean sort of a Kimi Antonelli coming in? Or
I think Formula One in general is at its, yeah, pretty much at its relative peak. I think you've got, Antonelli coming in, Ollie Bearman coming in could be a really great talent as well. And Jack Doohan coming in as well. I don't know if it'll be better than this year's or not. But I think generally Formula One's in a great space where talent is getting into the seats. Teams are spending huge money on signing big drivers. You've got teams like Sauber becoming Audi and needing two great pros in the seats. You've got Williams taking two great pros in the seats as well with Albon and Sainz. And generally, you look at the strength of depth of the midfielders and, you know, the tail enders, if there are such thing. Everyone is needing the best drivers out there to go and race. Haas signing Esteban Ocon and Ollie Bearman. There's not really any bad lineups for next year.
Yeah, it's exciting, isn't it?
Very much so.
Jolyon, it has been great to chat to you. I'm going to end this the traditional way, which is with our quick fire questions. I hope you're ready for this. What else are you good at?
Sports. Other sports. I don't know. Cycling, tennis, football.
So good hand-eye.
Hand-eye. Let's go with that.
If you could take a year off work and do one Olympic sport that you could get yourself good enough to qualify for the Olympics, what would it be?
I'm not shallow enough to think that I could possibly qualify for the Olympics or anything, but cycling's become a big thing for me. So I would never be a good enough cyclist, let's make this clear, but I do a lot of cycling in my spare time, so that.
Now, which racing person, dead or alive, would you like to be stuck in a lift with? Who were your heroes growing up?
Damon was one as a young Brit. I love a plucky underdog, and he was that in the 90s. Juan Pablo Montoya, such a great character when he was in Formula One as well. And Fernando, actually, when I was young and watching Fernando and seeing what he was achieving.
Would you want to be in a lift with any of them?
None of them. None of them. Yeah, I don't know who I'd... You've got to go for a Stirling Moss or someone, a legend from the past, haven't you, to hear all... I don't know. James Hunt's probably got some great stories as well.
Yeah. Who would play you in a film?
I'm really not a film buff. I have no idea. I'd want it to be a thriller, but I don't think my life as yet would warrant a Leonardo DiCaprio to play out the thriller Julian Palmer film.
Who is the coolest person in your contacts?
I don't think I've got like a status number that I'm proud to show off. Probably I've got a few, but I'm not a starstruck guy. Everyone's a human underneath it all.
Who would be your first guest if you had a podcast like this?
It would be you. The life and times of Tom Clarkson, the man that's spoken to all of the drivers to tell all of the great stories, of course.
You're not allowed me.
Oh, what?
I'm busy that day.
You wanting ideas for the next Beyond the Grid? I do think someone like Fernando or Lewis, you know, these guys have got such great experience. Fernando has had such big stories around his career as well. I know you've already spoken to him because I heard it already, but if I was doing my own one, I would do a not quite as good interview as you.
JP, do you know, with him, with Fernando, he's such a challenging, interesting person to speak to. Almost every sentence that comes out of his mouth in a press conference anyway is worth listening to, I find.
Yeah, I think that's the fascinating thing. So I grew up really admiring Fernando. Some of the seasons that he put together were brilliant, but the character, he's a very deep character as well. Everything that he does is thought out. Nothing with Fernando happens by chance. Even the, you mentioned the Russell Melbourne thing, and oh, it looks like Russell's in the wall. Ah, no, there's something more to it with Fernando nearby. So yeah, he's a very, very calculating person, but you know, he's immensely intelligent as well.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time. Great chat.
Always a pleasure. Cheers, Tom.
I loved this chat. Jolyon really understands the sport, and despite the frustrations of his own F1 career, he's a true fan. I love the fact that Damon Hill was one of his heroes, and it sounds like he and I are agreed on the phenomenon that is Fernando Alonso. Jolyon, thanks for your time, and I'll see you at a race again soon. And if you want to hear more from Jolyon, look out for his analysis on F1.com or on the F1 app. And if you live in a country where F1 TV is available, you can watch him there too. Now, let me know what you think of this chat. Through all the usual means, I'm at TomClarksonF1, or you can use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid. Which brings me on to what you sent in about last week's episode with Yuki Tsunoda. There's so much love for Yuki out there. We've received a lot of messages, and I especially like this one from Brendan Convery. Fantastic interview with Yuki, Tom. I love to hear the progression that Yuki's taken mentally and physically, and with his consistency, not to mention his English, has also improved at a very impressive rate. Do I hear a slight Aussie twang in Yuki's voice now? Well, Brendan, if there is an Aussie twang, that'll be thanks to his former physio, Aussie Michael Italiano. And thanks for the message. Well, that's almost it for this week. A couple of things before I go. F1 Nation's preview of the Azerbaijan Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by Aston Martin ambassador Pedro de la Rosa to discuss Adrian Newey's switch to Aston. Just what a story that is for both the team and Formula One. And this week's episode of F1 Explains is about the F1 calendar. You can find both of these pods right here on your podcast app. I'll be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. As ever, thanks very much for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.